Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I want to mention at the outset that tonight's program is being brought to you by the National Review Institute, our sponsors tonight. I'm not sure who's bringing us the music, but I didn't know you could play that well. The National Review Institute is the foundation that supports activities at National Review and works with partners, including libraries such as ours, around the country to be able to bring the writers and editors of National Review to us. Lindsay Craig, Lindsay, wave, stand up, from the National Review Institute is here. Should you be interested in their work, their pamphlets outside. They also do things such as the William F. Buckley Jr. Fellowship in Political Journalism, the regional partnership events such as this, Regional Fellows Program, and the William F. Buckley Jr. Prize Dinner, and an Ideas Summit as well. And we're grateful to have their support. I do also, at moments like this, mention that we have a similar relationship. They haven't provided quite as much support yet with the Nation Institute and with a number of other organizations, right, left, and center. Many of you know my politics, which are friendly to the event tonight, but we try to present as wide a range and as deep a range of political views at the library as we possibly can. So anyway, I also want to mention a couple of upcoming events, demonstrate our ecumenical attitude towards just about everything. We have coming up on Thursday, April 16th, which would, I guess, be tomorrow, here at Central Library, Jennifer Teague, who in investigating her family, she's African-American, found that her grandfather was Amon Göth, who was the Nazi commandant, who you might remember if you've seen Schindler's List, one of a person genuinely evil. And the title of her talk tomorrow night here is My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me. So you can imagine that will be a pretty interesting event. We have another great historian, a great biographer and historian coming on April 22nd at the Plaza Library. This is a return engagement for Lewis Gould, one of the great historians of late 19th century America and early 20th century America. And he'll be talking as part of our Beyond the Gown series, our series on the First Ladies with the Truman Library, about Edith Kermit Roosevelt. Again, I think you'll enjoy that. Lewis is an excellent lecturer and a great historian. On April 29th, we have a return engagement of Bob Day. Some of you will know Robert Day. He is the cult cowboy novelist, the author of The Last Cattle Drive, which over the last 40 years remains in print. As I say, is a cult novel with a great following, and he's a wonderful character. And he'll be talking to his friend, which is appropriate given that we've got Rick Brookhiser tonight talking about Lincoln, Joshua Schenck, who has written a very good book about Lincoln, Lincoln's Melancholy, but who's also recently written a book called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs, talking about partnerships, in some cases marriages, in some cases business partners or partners in ideas, in enterprise, and how partnership can be creative. And the two of them will be talking together about this, and that promises to be very interesting. And last but not least this month, I want to mention Eric Honoshek, also a return engagement, part of our ongoing series that we do with the Kauffman Foundation about what works in urban education. And Eric Honoshek will talk, is probably the leading scholar of this particular topic in the United States, one that should be important to all of us who care about public education, the economic value of teacher quality. When Eric was here before talking about education reform generally, he was asked from the audience at the end of his talk if we could do only one thing, and the burden of his lecture was we need to do more than one thing, but he was asked the question, if we could do only one thing to improve public education, what would we do? And he said, improve teacher quality. And he'll be talking about that here at the Central Library on April 30th. Now, Rick Brookhiser. He is living my real life. In 1969, when I was at Andover, and I resigned as the head of the Young Americans for Freedom high school division in Massachusetts, Bill Buckley wrote me a letter. He wrote me a letter and said he'd like to talk to me about that, that he thought it was an interesting thing that I'd done. I'd written a letter about this. It was published and whatnot. And so eventually I went to National Review and had a meeting with Bill Buckley and went to an editorial board meeting and met some other people at National Review. And I had this dream in my head that I would be a writer for National Review. And I think I started work on a piece on education that I would write for National Review. I think I'm still working on it, actually. and almost simultaneously to that meeting with Bill Buckley, there was published in National Review a piece by a 15-year-old that was a cover piece in National Review about anti-Vietnam War protests at his high school. And it was by Rick Brookhiser, Richard Brookhiser, who is here tonight. And I followed Rick's career thinking, this is exactly the career that I envisioned for myself. He became a senior editor at National Review at the age of 23, wrote columns for National Review, for the New York Observer, wrote for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New Yorker, et cetera. This was my career as I envisioned it. And of course, eventually began to write the wonderful biographies, the great narratives of the founders that he's been working on, and I'm still working on that piece for National Review. But as I follow his career, I'm fascinated by what he's done, moving from the contemporary political world, which he started out writing about, to these biographies of the founders, to the origins of our politics, our polity, if you will. He's written biographies, as some of you will know, of Washington, a couple actually, of books on Washington, Hamilton, Madison, the most colorful of the founders, whom I particularly like, Gouverneur Morris. And of course now he's written this book about Abraham Lincoln as essentially the son of these men that he's been writing about. Son, actually, particularly, I think, in this book of Jefferson. I was at Monticello, where I was a board member for a while, a couple of nights ago for the dinner that they give for the Jefferson medals. The UVA doesn't, University of Virginia doesn't have honorary degrees, so they give medals in honor of Jefferson, given by Monticello, actually, as in essence the honorary degrees. And we heard this, the medal for citizen leadership went to John Lewis, Congressman Lewis, who, as many of you know, organized the march from Selma to Montgomery and was virtually the first person beaten by Sheriff Clark's minions. And he spoke to the assembled board members, et cetera, and it was one of the most eloquent things I've ever heard. And I was thinking about Rick's book and about what Lincoln would have felt about. There's really a linear genealogical descent, if you will, from Jefferson to Lincoln to what Martin Luther King and John Lewis did. Because this book tells the story of Abraham Lincoln as essentially the man who tried to unite the Declaration, the philosophy of the Declaration, and the philosophy of the Constitution. To unite equality and democracy, idealism, and the rule of law, and it's also a great series of set pieces of individuals that Lincoln encounters, from Henry Clay when he's a young politician, there's a wonderful analysis of a Clay speech and its relationship to Lincoln, where Rick is particularly good about the poetry of politics, and he quotes this great line from Clay's speech, which he says, "The slaveholders want to blow out the moral lights around us," and then he goes on to Lincoln saying, "Slavery is founded on selfishness, and the opposition to it is founded in justice. This is a great book because it's essentially a moral book. It's a moral history of the United States from essentially the 1840s to the 1860s and beyond. And through all of it, there is the sense that the union of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution in Lincoln's mind, perhaps in Jefferson's and the other founders, can be seen in something that Lincoln said about the founders, that they clung to the idea of freedom. It was ultimately about the idea of freedom. And so tonight, Guggenheim Fellow, senior editor of National Review, the recipient of the National Humanities Medal from President Bush, the man who's living my real life, Rick Brookhiser.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. We're always accepting pieces. And in fact, we found about a year ago in our files a piece by Jack Kerouac that he had submitted to us. And this was before your time and my time. It had been sitting there. And I know what Bill Buckley would have done with that. He would have published it and sent a standard check to the Kerouac estate. Unfortunately, we contacted the estate first, and they said, no, don't you dare ever publish that. So we lost that opportunity. Lincoln was concerned with the Founding Fathers all his life. And the most famous expression of that was in the Gettysburg Address, where he said, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty. And that was November 1863. But 3 years before that, February 1860, in the Cooper Union Address, which was the kickoff of his first presidential campaign and his East Coast debut as a politician, he said in New York City of slavery that as our fathers marked it, so let it again be marked as an evil not to be extended. Let us speak as they spoke, and let us act as they acted upon it. And 6 years before that, October 1854, in his Peoria speech, the longest speech he ever gave, 3 hours long, he said, our Republican robe is soiled and trailed in the dust. Let us turn and wash it white in the spirit, if not in the blood, of the Revolution. And tonight I want to talk about the three founding fathers who were most important to Lincoln: George Washington, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson. He encountered them at different times in his life and took different things from them, but they all mattered to him a great deal. And I also want to talk about two other fathers, his actual father, Thomas Lincoln. And I think one source of the devotion that he brought to the founding fathers was a displacement of emotion that he could never feel for Thomas. And then the fifth father, as the Civil War goes on, is God the Father, when even the founding fathers are no longer enough to explain to him what is going on, what is happening to the country. Thomas Lincoln was born in Virginia, but he married and started his family in Kentucky. He had three children, Sarah, Abraham, and a second son, Thomas, who died after 3 days. Abraham was born in 1809, and then in 1816, Thomas moved his family to Indiana, brand new state. And then in 1830, the Lincolns moved to Illinois, which was where Thomas stayed for the rest of his life. Now, there was a fashion in the early and mid-20th century to write of Thomas as a ne'er-do-well, and historians have moved beyond that. He was a subsistence farmer and carpenter all his life, never wanted to be anything else. But he never left bad debts. He never went bankrupt. He served on several juries, which was a sign of respectability if not prosperity. And he was also the trustee of a Baptist church in Indiana where the Lincolns worshiped. His first wife, Abraham's father, died when Abraham was 9 years old. Thomas waited a year, and then he went back to Kentucky, and he looked up Sarah Bush Johnson, who was an old friend of his. She was then a widow. And he said to her, "You've lost your husband, I've lost my wife, we've known each other for years. Why don't you become my wife and take care of my family?" She agreed. She said she had a few small debts she wanted to pay first. He said, "Give me a list, I'll pay them." He paid them that day, and then the next day, she and her children moved with him to Indiana and his children. He also sent Sarah and Abraham to school, one-room schoolhouses. He wanted them to learn how to read and write. Abraham went to 5 schools in his childhood, 2 of them when he was a little boy in Kentucky, 3 in Indiana. If you add up all his schooling, it adds up to a year. And he learned how to read, write, and do simple arithmetic. So Thomas Lincoln, in many ways, was a responsible man and a responsible father. But the father and son never got along. They never saw eye to eye. One of the reasons was work. Because as soon as Abraham was a teenager and filled out to his adult growth, his father would loan him out to neighbors to plow their fields, to split their rails, and all the money that Abraham earned, Thomas would pocket. Now, this was a common practice, but common practices take different people different ways, and Abraham did not like it. I think it's reasonable to see some of his opposition to slavery growing out of the fact that he felt he had worked without compensation for his labor. Now, of course, that condition ended when he turned 21 and went off on his own, and for a slave, it never ends unless he happens to be freed, but that is always up to the master. But still, Abraham felt some kinship with the unpaid labor of slaves. A second source of disagreement between father and son was education. Thomas Lincoln wanted his children to read and write because he thought they were useful skills for a farmer or a laborer to have. But for Abraham, reading and writing were windows into his own consciousness and outside to other worlds. He read every book he could get his hands on. He didn't get his hands on many, but he read them all. We have a description of how he read and thought from his stepmother, Sarah Bush Lincoln. She was more like him than his own father. And she said after Abraham died, she was interviewed as an old lady, and she described how the boy, if adults were over at the cabin and they talked about something that he didn't understand, he would wait until they had gone, and then he'd ask, "What was that about? What did that mean?" And then he'd write it down. And then he'd rewrite it in his own words until he was sure he understood it. If he didn't have a pencil, he would write it on a board with charcoal. When he filled up the board, he'd plane off the board so he could write more. When he was plowing, he'd take a book with him. And when the horse stopped to rest, he'd read a few pages and then go back to the furrow. And then the next time the horse stopped, he'd read again. And this was something that his father just never got, never understood. In 1860, when Lincoln has to write a campaign autobiography for his first presidential run, he said of his father that he never learned more than to bunglingly write his own name. And I thought there's so much emotion in that word, bunglingly, so much bad emotion. Lincoln is saying, you never learned to write more than your own name because you didn't want to. But I wanted to, so I did. So the two men just were not on the same wavelength. Nevertheless, there were 3 things that the son got from his father. The first was physical strength. Thomas and Abraham were differently built. Thomas was 5'10", stocky. Abraham was 6'4", and gangly. But they were both strong. This was important in frontier America. for men. Because when you moved into a new place, there was communal hazing. You would have to prove yourself with the local tough guy. And both Thomas and Abraham experienced those tests and passed them. So strength was an important thing in the old Midwest. The second thing the son got from his father was that neither of them drank. And in early 19th century America, this was remarkable. The United States was a country of alcoholics. I've read scholars trying to calculate how much people drank per year, and it's just an astonishing amount. And of course, a lot of this is because the water was bad. The alcohol was, you wouldn't get sick from the alcohol, or you'd get differently sick, but you wouldn't get diseases that would kill you right away. And also, alcohol was self-medication for aches and pains, for depression, for loneliness, all sorts of reasons. But in a nation of hard, heavy drinking, neither Thomas Lincoln nor his son indulged. But the third and the most important thing that Abraham got from his father was storytelling. And we know this from two of Abraham's cousins on his mother's side, John and Dennis Hanks. And both these men spent several years living with the Lincolns and knew Abraham when he was growing up. And one of them said that Thomas Lincoln was as good a storyteller as Abraham, and the other one said Thomas Lincoln was better. And stories were, they were useful to Abraham as a lawyer, which he became, and a politician. They would set people at ease, juries, judges, audiences. They could also distract people and keep them away from him. One of his Illinois cronies, a man named Leonard Swett, described Lincoln after he won his first presidential nomination. And he's in Springfield, Illinois, and suddenly everyone descends upon him, and they want favors, they want jobs, they want this and that. And Swett said he heard them all, he told them all a story, and he sent them away. So stories were a very important thing for Lincoln, and he'd learned those from his father. Thomas Lincoln died in 1851. Abraham named a horse after him, Old Tom. He named his fourth son after him, Thomas or Tad. Then in 1861, as he was about to go to Washington, he visited his father's grave. He saw that there was no stone on it, and he said, I'll have to put one up, and he never did. So that was the relationship between the father and son. If we don't get everything we want or need from our parents, none of us ever does, we look for it from surrogates. And for a young man in early 19th century America, the handiest, the most impressive surrogates were the founding fathers. Now, none of them ever came to Kentucky or Indiana or Illinois, and Lincoln never went east until he was an adult after the last of the founding fathers had died. So the only way he could meet them was in books. And the first founding father he met, George Washington, he met him in one of the first great American biographies, The Life of General George Washington by Mason Locke Weems, Parson Weems. Now, Parson Weems was an Episcopal clergyman. On the title page of his book, he said he was the parson of Mount Vernon Parish. Now, there is no such parish. He was not the parson of it. But he had met Washington once. He'd written him one letter, so he thought he had a connection to the great man. And he made his living as a bookseller. He would go up and down the East Coast selling books, many of them that he had printed, a lot of them that he had written. Washington dies in 1799, and Weems knows that a biography is going to be a bestseller. So in 1800, he's out with The Life of George Washington. In 1808, he has an expanded edition a year before Lincoln is born. And this is the book that Lincoln would have read possibly as early as Kentucky, certainly by the time he moved to Indiana. And Weems is one of those writers like James Fenimore Cooper or H.P. Lovecraft. His sentences aren't very good, but his stories are terrific. And the proof is that we know one of them. Everybody knows the story of Washington and the cherry tree. It's just gone into the national mind. And of course, the story is that George's father, when he's a little boy, he gives him a hatchet, and young George, he's swinging it around, and he accidentally barks a prize cherry tree. And Augustine Washington sees the damage to his tree, and he asks his son, "Do you know how this happened?" And George says, "I can't tell a lie, Pa. You know I can't tell a lie. I did it." And then his father praises him for his honesty. So it's a story with a moral. The moral for children is to tell the truth, and the moral to parents is that if your child does something bad but admits it, don't punish them, but praise them for their honesty. But this is not the story that impressed Lincoln. He was not impressed by Weems's tales of Washington as a good boy. He was impressed by Weems's stories of Washington as a great man. And we know this because Lincoln himself said so in 1861 when he was on the way to Washington to be inaugurated. He left Springfield in February, and he took a train through the Midwest and the Northeast. He was showing the flag as the country was falling apart. South Carolina had seceded in December, and the states of the Gulf Coast had seceded in January. He came through New Jersey to Trenton, New Jersey, on February 21st, the day before Washington's birthday, and he addressed the New Jersey legislature. And he told them that he had read a little book way back in my childhood, Weems's Life of Washington. And he said that of all the battles that Weems recounted, the one that most impressed him was the Battle of Trenton. And this was Washington's desperate end-of-the-year attack on the British, who had been pursuing him for half a year from Brooklyn, from New York, through White Plains, all the way across New Jersey, across the Delaware into Pennsylvania, and then at the very end of the year, at the very end of America's rope, Washington's army turns, attacks the Hessian mercenary allies of the British in Trenton, captures 900 prisoners with only a few casualties. It was the victory that saved the cause from certain defeat. Then Lincoln... He describes the battle briefly, but then he goes on to say that, "Boy though I was, I knew that there must have been something important that those men struggled for, something even more than independence, something of importance to all men and all times." And what Lincoln meant by that was liberty. And this, to me, is the proof that Lincoln was actually remembering Parson Weems. Because if you go to his book and read his account of the Battle of Trenton, this is exactly how Weems describes it. After he's described the crossing of the Delaware, the American army has a couple miles march before it gets to Trenton. And when he describes that march, he introduces an allegorical figure hovering over the troops. It's a woman, the Spirit of Liberty. And Weems says she's been driven out of Europe. She's come to America as her last refuge, but her enemy has followed her with soldiers and armies. Who will defend her? Only this ragged band of men. And then when he finally gets the army to Trenton, he makes Washington say to his troops, "All I ask of you is to remember what you are about to fight for." In 1861, Abraham Lincoln remembered, and that's what he took from George Washington. That was the inspiration that he got from Washington's life as a boy. When Lincoln was a young man in his 20s, he encountered his second founding father, and this was Thomas Paine. Paine was the great journalist of the American Revolution. His pamphlet, The American Crisis, I think has the greatest lead paragraph that's ever been in journalism or ever will be. This is the paragraph that begins, "These are the times that try men's souls." But Paine turned to religion after the Revolutionary War, and he wrote a notorious book called The Age of Reason. And this book also circulated in early America, along with his patriotic writings. And Lincoln read it in the 1820s when he was a young man in Illinois. Now, Paine was never an atheist. He always said, "I believe in one God and no more." But he was a ferocious enemy of all organized religions. In the Age of Reason, he makes some cracks at Islam. He makes more at Judaism. But his main target is Christianity, which is the religion he grew up in and the religion of most of the readers of his book. And Paine says that he first turned against religion when he was 7 or 8 years old, and someone in his family gave a home reading of a sermon on substitutionary atonement, which is the Christian doctrine that Christ died for our sins. He took our sins upon himself and paid the price in his own crucifixion. And then Paine says he walked out into the garden, and he claims to remember the very steps on which he had this thought. And he writes, "I revolted at the recollection of what I had heard, and thought to myself that it was making God Almighty act like a passionate man that killed his son when he could not revenge himself any other way. And as I was sure a man would be hanged that did such a thing, I could not see for what purpose they preach such sermons." This is also an instance not only of Paine's beliefs, but of his techniques. He takes the Bible very literally, and he applies what he would say is the test of common sense to it. Now, there's been centuries of theology about the crucifixion and its meaning. Paine has no interest in any of that. He's just looking at the text and wrestling directly with it. So he's sort of the ideal or the ideally wrong opponent for a nation of Bible readers. Paine is fundamentalism and literalism standing on its head. And this is why he was kind of a scandalous underground success in a nation like the United States. So Lincoln, like many 20-somethings, he encounters ideas of this kind, and he thinks, great, I don't have to pay attention to the religion I was raised in. It's all full of contradictions and holes. I don't have to believe any of it anymore. And he's so taken with these notions that he writes a Paineite pamphlet of his own. And at this time in his life, he was working as a postmaster. He had a number of jobs in his early 20s. He was a blacksmith. He was a riverboatman. He was a surveyor before he finally settles on politics and law. And in those days, postmasters did not have post offices. They would have a desk in someone's store, and that's where people would bring their mail and come to pick up their mail. So Lincoln is at his desk in this older man's store, and he's telling all his cronies, his also 20-something friends, about this pamphlet that he's written. And the owner of the store, who was an older man named Hill, asked to see the pamphlet, and he put it in the stove. And the reason he did that is because Lincoln was already interested in politics. And Mr. Hill knew you don't win votes in Illinois in the 1830s by writing pamphlets saying that the Bible is full of holes. So he spared young Lincoln the embarrassment of having this pamphlet being discovered in an election, you know, at some later point. Now, Lincoln learned to be discreet about his views, and over the years his views would change. And I do want to get to that. But one thing that he got from Paine that he always retained was how to use humor to win serious arguments. Now, he already knew about humor. He'd learned that from his father. He'd learned that from his father in storytelling. But Paine showed him how to use humor as a weapon in making serious points. Another argument of Paine's, he's talking about the virgin birth, and he says if any girl today were to say that she was pregnant and that the father was a ghost and that an angel told her so, would she be believed? Now, again, there's a lot of theology about the virgin birth, but Paine is dismissing all that. He's just dealing with the literal facts, and he's putting a humorous spin on it. And this is a technique that Lincoln would use over and over again. When he's running for Senate and later for president, a common Democratic campaign technique was to say that Republicans were only interested in restricting slavery because they were race mixers. They wanted to sleep with black women. This could be the only reason they would have the positions they held. So Lincoln's response to this, and he said it over and over again, was that just because I don't want a black woman for a slave doesn't mean I have to have her as a wife. I can let her alone. And he's making a joke, but he's also making a serious point, because if you let her alone, you're letting her alone to be free. And this was the kind of use of humor and a serious purpose that I believe Lincoln took from Paine. The third founding father that he encounters, and this is when he is a mature politician in his 40s, in the 1850s, is Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson had a very long life, a very complex life. He has an interesting mind. It sometimes seems to me that Jefferson's mind is like a house with a lot of rooms and they don't all have doors. Jefferson can hesitate about some of his principles. He can back off them as he grows older. But the Jefferson that Lincoln reveres is the young Jefferson, the man who at age 33 wrote the Declaration of Independence. And this was the document, especially the statement that all men are created equal, the first of the self-evident truths that Lincoln would return to again and again in the 1850s and 1860s. In 1859, he was invited to Boston to a celebration of Jefferson's birthday. He couldn't go because of legal business, but he wanted to send a tribute to Jefferson, and he labored over this tribute because he hoped it would be printed in Republican newspapers, which it was. And he said that Jefferson's ideas were the definitions and axioms of a free society, and he concluded, "All honor to Jefferson, to the man who had the coolness, forecast, and capacity to introduce into a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth applicable to all men and all times." So that's almost what he would say in Trenton in 1861 about Washington crossing the Delaware. But that was a battle and an action. And here he's applying it to Jefferson and a statement, an eloquent statement of principle. And Lincoln, of course, his most famous invocation of Jefferson is the Gettysburg Address, which begins 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth. So 47, 87 from 1863 is 1776. So the particular constellation of fathers he's pointing to is the authors of the Declaration of Independence, the signers of it, and especially Thomas Jefferson, the author. Now, the Gettysburg Address was given to inaugurate a cemetery. And there were a lot of cemeteries in Lincoln's life. His mother had died when he was 9. His sister Sarah died when he was 20. His first sweetheart died in his early 20s. Several of his friends at the time said that he was so grief-stricken over that they had to hide the razors. He was particularly disturbed by the thought of rain falling on this young woman's grave. And that to me is a sign of his depression, which was lifelong, because rain falls. I mean, it falls everywhere. It falls on everything. But he was tormented by the thought of it falling on this young woman's grave. He'd never fought in battle himself, although he'd served in an Indian war called the Black Hawk War. This was in northwestern Illinois in the 1830s. And he had seen some men who'd been scalped. And he remembered that on the top of every head there was a spot the size of a silver dollar. And he said that blood seemed to be everywhere. But this was a common experience of death in early 19th century America. There were a number of Indian conflicts. There was the War of 1812. There was the Mexican War. There was also just a lot of mortality from disease. But the Civil War was not common. The Civil War was something else. And it touched Lincoln personally a number of times. One of the first engagements was in May 1861, when Union troops took Alexandria, Virginia, from the rebels. Alexandria was visible by spyglass from Washington, D.C. You could see it from the White House. And there was a Confederate flag flying over one of the hotels in Alexandria. A Union unit went in to take it down. It was commanded by a man named Elmer Ellsworth, who'd been Lincoln's law student in Illinois. He'd accompanied him on his train trip into his first inauguration. The owner of the hotel killed Ellsworth with a shotgun, and then he was killed in turn by Ellsworth's second in command. At the end of 1861, one of Lincoln's political friends from Illinois, Edwin Baker, was killed at the Battle of Ball's Bluff. Lincoln had named a son after Baker. Baker had introduced Lincoln to the crowd from the podium at his first inaugural. Baker had moved to Oregon and become a senator. But now he was killed in battle, and someone at the funeral described Lincoln as weeping like a child. One of Lincoln's acquaintances from his days as a lawyer was a man named William McCullough. He was the court clerk in Bloomington County. At the start of the war, McCullough asked Lincoln's help to get into an Illinois cavalry regiment. The reason he needed Lincoln's help was that he was 50 years old and he only had one arm. He'd lost an arm in a farming accident, but he wanted to fight for the Union and for liberty. So Lincoln got him into a regiment. He became a colonel of that regiment, and he was killed in 1862 in northern Mississippi on the run-up to Vicksburg. And it was to McCullough's daughter that Lincoln wrote one of his most eloquent letters. She was grief-stricken by her father's death, and Lincoln said, well, the young always take grief worse than the old because they haven't learned to expect it. And that time would help her, and if she could only believe that now, it would begin the process of helping her. Sometimes what he saw was injury. He and his wife would visit hospitals for Union soldiers, and on one of his visits, he went with a young reporter named Noah Brooks. He'd known Brooks from Illinois, and then Brooks moved to California, and the Sacramento Union then sent him to Washington to cover the war. So because of his Illinois connection, he had good access to Lincoln. And one day, he accompanied the president and the first lady on a visit to a hospital. And as Lincoln and Brooks were going down the line of beds, there was a charitable woman ahead of them who was giving the soldiers tracts. And she came to one soldier. He picked up the tract and glanced at it and then tossed it down on his bed with a smirk. And then when Lincoln and Brooks came up to him, the president said, well, she's just trying to be helpful. It's probably not right to laugh at her. And the young man said, well, she gave me a tract on the sin of dancing and both my legs have been shot off. And it has the shape of a joke. It could be one of Lincoln's jokes. But of course, the joke was on the president himself and on the young man who'd lost his legs. And so you multiply these events by 10 and by 100 and by 1,000 and by 100,000. And that's what the war is like for the president, because all the casualty reports come to him. He is at the peak of the pyramid of the military. He is the commander-in-chief. All the successes, all the failures, and all the injuries and all the deaths come to him. And Lincoln, as the war lengthens, tries to understand what is happening and why. And we have to know that he was a fatalist. This was a lifelong conviction. The church that his parents belonged to, the particular kind of Baptist they were, believed in predestination. And although Lincoln left their church, he never left that belief. He believed that everything had a cause and that cause had a cause and so on and so on, back and back. And one of his ways of expressing it was, he had a little catchphrase. He would say that the motive is born before the man. So even before you're born, everything you do has had a cause that's had a cause that's had a cause. And of course, all these causes ultimately go back to God, who creates the universe, creates everything in it. And so Lincoln is trying to reconcile what is happening in this universe with God's omnipotent superintendence of it. And the final conclusion that he comes up with is in his second inaugural, which he delivers in March 1865. And there he says, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago," he's talking about Psalm 19, "so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Well, two things are striking about that. One is how far he's moved from pain. I mean, not only is he quoting the Bible, but Paine, who was revolted by the substitutionary atonement, he couldn't accept that because it was like God killing his own son. But here Lincoln was saying God is killing hundreds of thousands of sons to pay for a sin that they didn't commit, for the sin of American slavery, which is the sin of all of us. And the other striking thing is the math of that sentence. The Gettysburg Address was 47 years ago, 87 years from 1863. But this is 250 years of unrequited toil. And 250 from 1865 is 1615. It's Jamestown, the first American colony, the first colony to have slaves. So the founding fathers are gone from this speech. It's the only major speech Lincoln gives, except for the House Divided speech, which does not mention them. They are all subsumed in the sweep of American slavery, which is what we're paying for in the Civil War. But the speech doesn't end there. It does have a final paragraph, one sentence long. "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." And what struck me about that as I came to write about it is how many of those verbs and verb phrases are two syllables long. Strive on, finish, bind up, care for, do all, achieve, cherish. It's like walking. It's as simple as walking. And it's as hard as walking when you've walked so long and you have so far yet to go. Thanks. So I guess we have time for questions.
Questions and maybe repeat the question.
Sure, sure. Yes, sir.
Could you talk a little bit, please, about his letters that he wrote during the Civil War to people, women particularly, who had written to him in relation to the losses of their soldiers and how many of these he wrote?
Well, the most famous one, of course, is the one to Mrs. Bixby. And that um, That's quoted in Saving Private Ryan. I think it's the very opening of Saving Private Ryan. Lincoln was told by the War Department that there was a woman in Boston who had had five sons who died in battle. And there's some dispute over whether Lincoln wrote this letter or whether his secretary, John Hay, wrote it. But it's an eloquent letter to this woman. It really says, there is nothing I can say, but you do have the nation's thanks. We now know that one of her sons died in battle. One may have died in a prison camp, Confederate prison camp, and the other three survived. But, well, I mean, isn't two bad enough? Isn't one bad enough? Of course it is. Some of his most moving interactions with women are the ones who came face to face. There was towards the end of the war, and we know this from his friend Joshua Speed. This was a man that he knew when he first moved to Springfield. He was probably the only friend Lincoln ever had. They were cut from the same cloth. They were both poetic. They were both depressed. They bonded for a number of years, and then Speed moved back. He was from Kentucky. He moved back there, and they did stay in touch, and they had some arguments about slavery in the 1850s. Speed was a slave owner, but Speed was also a Unionist, so once the Civil War began, they drew closer again politically. And Speed came to visit Lincoln on a couple of occasions, and on one of them, Lincoln said, "Look, I'm just finishing up with my callers. You know, wait till I'm done, and then we can talk." And the last two were these two women from Speed remembered them being from Western Pennsylvania, and it was the mother of a man who'd been arrested for draft resistance, and the wife of another man who'd been arrested also for draft resistance. And you know, Lincoln said, What are you here for?" And they said, "Well, we couldn't write a petition. We didn't have the money to have one written, so we came ourselves." And it seems as if this was an ongoing case, that Lincoln was familiar with it. So he called in, you know, somebody, and he said, "Let's release them all." The phrase he used was, "Let's turn off the flock, turn off the whole flock." And then one of the women got down on her knees to Lincoln. And Lincoln said, "You must not do that." You know, he raised her up, and he said, "You know, thank God and go." And then the other one, the older one, she took his hand and she said, "Oh, Mr. Lincoln, I will never see you again until I see you in heaven." And Lincoln said, "Well, I don't think with all my troubles that I'll ever get there, but you know, your wish that I would is a great comfort to me." And then when they were gone, Speed said to him, "You know, Lincoln, with your nervous sensibility, I don't see how you stand this." And Lincoln said, "This is the only thing that's given me pleasure all day." So Lincoln had a soft spot, particularly for older women and widows, which I think is part of the reason that this scene was so moving, because one of those women was older. And there are a couple other instances. I think maybe, possibly, he was recalling his stepmother, you know, who had been widowed before Thomas Lincoln married her. But yes, he could, you know, in the pressure of like running the war and, you know, trying to get rid of this incompetent Union general and maybe hopefully replacing him with a better one, and, you know, dealing with everybody's arguments and backbiting and all the, you know, all the million things that go on, the craziness of it all. He was able at times to have these connections with individuals. Yes, sir.
How many years did you spend on this book?
Well, the founders part of it, I mean, I've been spending years on them. The reason I wrote the book, I was at Yale talking about my Madison book for a group called the Federalist Society. And there's a professor on the Yale Law School named Akhil Amar, who himself has written many interesting books about constitutional law. He's an old friend of mine. And we had coffee afterwards, and Akhil said, "Rick, I know what your next book should be." And I said, "Oh, what's that?" And he said, "You should write a book about Lincoln and the Founding Fathers and call it Founder's Son." I said, "That's a great idea. You know, I just saw this is brilliant." So, my editor agreed to publish it. And so I read for a year and I wrote for a year. I mean, but still, of course, reading along. And one thing that has made life easier over the 20 years that I've been writing biographies is how much is online now. You know, in the early 90s when I started, very little. But now, I mean, all of Lincoln's works are online. Google has digitized all these out-of-print books. So if you want the memoirs of Senator Jones, published in 1871, you know, it's online. You can just find it. I did have to chase something down in 19th century newspapers, and those are harder to get. And there I had to call on a bright young PhD in history whom I'd worked with before in another context, and she helped me out. But it spares you, maybe I shouldn't say this in a library, it spares you trips to buildings such as this. But not for newspapers. Yes, sir. Well, you know, I think part of it is, and only part, and the lesser part, but part of it certainly is the Bible as writing. You know, Lincoln is a great writer, and the King James Version is great writing, and he just responded to it on that level. Noah Brooks said one of his favorite lines, it's from the Old Testament, "The stars in their courses fought against Sisera." And he was, I believe, a Canaanite general who is, you know, loses out to the Israelites and is finally killed. And, you know, I can just see how Lincoln would have loved that line. It's inevitability, you know, Sisera, there's nothing Sisera can do, the stars are against him. But also the R's, the stars and their courses fought against Sisera. I mean, it's just this wonderful music. But I don't think it was just music. I think, you know, Lincoln was a recovering painite. he was an ex-painite. And because Paine, you know, and I have an affection for Paine. Paine is a good writer. He's certainly very feisty, sort of Christopher Hitchens in the 19th century. But there are limits to it, you know. And Paine doesn't know about tragedy. He just doesn't. He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand it. And so if you want to understand it, where do you then go? And where Lincoln went, and one of the places he went, was the Bible. And it clearly shows up in his, as you said, in his speeches. He's quoting it, he's referring to it. And I do not believe that's what the audience wants. You know, I'll give the American public what they want. I don't think so. He's giving himself what he needs. Yes, sir.
You had mentioned that Lincoln had witnessed at least one scalping.
Well, the aftermath, the aftermath.
Yeah, minor role in the Black Hawk Red Stick Wars. And I'm thinking about the 1859 largest hanging of one, you know, of the Lakota people. The Sioux people have a real animosity towards Lincoln. Mm. He loved the blacks but hated red people. Do you see any animosity towards Native Americans?
Abraham Lincoln was killed by an Indian. That was his paternal grandfather. And Lincoln knew that because Thomas was there as a little boy. He was in the field with his two brothers. And Abraham was in his 40s. This was a Virginian. And an Indian shot Abraham, killed him, and went to pick up Thomas and run off with him. And one of Thomas's brothers had gone back to the cabin and got a gun and shot the Indian. And now Lincoln said, this was a legend in my own family. So clearly Thomas, he was 7 years old. I mean, he told this story, obviously, a lot. So there's some history. Now, the hanging, it was during the Civil War, when you'd said 1859, but it was when Lincoln was president. And, you know, a lot of tenderness went by the board in the Civil War, and it wasn't just the hanging of Indians. I mean, habeas corpus was suspended nationwide. There was just a lot of stuff went on. And Lincoln, you know, to his credit, he tried to keep it constitutional always. Yes, ma'am. Well, sure. I only didn't include it because he wasn't actually killed in battle or anything related to it. But yes, he lost. He had two sons who died. The first one died in the very early 1850s, and then the second one died while he was president. This is devastating. This is devastating for any parent. It was particularly bad for Mary Lincoln, who was, you know, just not stable to begin with. And living with him was not easy either. I mean, I think he had the worst of it, but he was no prize either. What he would do is he would check out. You know, she'd be after him. There was one story where she was preparing dinner, and he was reading in the parlor, and she asked him to, I think, poke the fire. You know, and she asked him the first time, and he didn't. She asked him the second time, and he didn't. And the third time, and he didn't. And the fourth time, and he didn't. And then finally, she threw something at him, and then he took a walk. You know, you multiply that, and she didn't. Once she threw hot coffee in his face. I mean, it was troubled. She was very interested in politics, which is one of the reasons they first got along. They met in a presidential election. It was a campaign romance. She was very interested in poetry. She was an attractive young woman. She was from a classy Kentucky family, you know, so he was sort of marrying up. And then she was just devastated by the death of Willie during the war. She thought that was God's punishment for her ambition. So Lincoln is dealing both with the death of his son and then with the reaction of his wife. And yes, and that's awful, but it's like a rowboat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which has an ocean-wide storm. So it's hard to conceive of what he was going through. Yes, sir. He did go. There was a church in Washington, I think it was Presbyterian, that he would go to. You know, did he pray? I mean, you get different opinions on this from different people who were close to him. And I think maybe the final conclusion is no one was really close to this man. You know, after Speed, I don't think he let anybody in. And so, you know, one of his probably best early biographers was a man named William Herndon, who'd worked in his law office, 9 years younger. And it was always Mr. Lincoln and Billy. So that was the relationship between the two. And Herndon adored Lincoln, just adored him. And he figured out early on, this is a remarkable man. And Herndon was very observant. I mean, he observed this guy. They were partners for 16 years. And then after Lincoln is murdered, Herndon decides, well, I have to write a book. And then he did a lot of research. I mean, he interviewed Lincoln's stepmother. He interviewed the Hanks cousins. He went around to Kentucky and Indiana, and he sent people when he couldn't go. And a lot of what we know about Lincoln's early life is the result of Herndon digging around. But even Herndon didn't get close to Lincoln. And Herndon was himself a kind of anti-religious, I guess you'd call him a transcendentalist. And he always had quarrels with the Christian clergy of Springfield. So, you know, his take on Lincoln is through that lens. Speed, became religious at the end of his life. So when he's talking about Lincoln after the war, he's talking about him through that lens. And then John Hay, who was one of Lincoln's secretaries, said, Herndon wrote him and said, did Lincoln's views, religious views, change during his presidency? And Hay said, no, they didn't change at all. But, you know, this is like people, like the blind men describing an elephant, you know, and the guy who has the trunk says, well, it's a big snake, look, it's like, you know, and the guy who has the hoof says, well, it's like a column, that's what the elephant is like. So, you know, there are some people who say, oh, yes, you know, yes, Lincoln was openly pious, and others who say, ah, nonsense, it never happened. So it's very hard to figure out. It seems to me that he's clearly, well, I'll tell you one thing that did strike me. He met one person he met with, and I write about this in my book. She was a Quaker woman named Eliza Gurney. And she came with a party of Quakers after the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation had been announced. And one characteristic about a number of the religious or groups of religious people who came to Lincoln when he's president is before the Emancipation Proclamation, they're urging him to emancipate the slaves. You know, why haven't you done this? You should do this. It's your Christian duty to do this. You know, and Lincoln is trying to hold Kentucky in the Union. I mean, yes, he understands all that, but he's balancing a lot. So then he does issue the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, and this group of Quakers comes. And Eliza Gurney, I don't know what the Quaker term for it is. It isn't praying before him. I think it's an exhortation. Because Quakers felt, maybe still feel, that if the Spirit moves you, you should speak. And women can speak equally with men. You know, Quakers have never had sex distinctions. So Eliza Gurney gives this impromptu sermon to Lincoln. And what struck me about it, and it's written, someone wrote a version of it in a memoir of hers that was published years later, is instead of hocking Lincoln to do something, she's trying to help him. She's saying, you know, I hope the president, there is a river of life which can refresh us, and I hope the president can come to that river of life. And this is imagery from Revelation. And I think she got to Lincoln, partly because she's older. She's an older woman, also a widow. Her husband has died. And Lincoln reveals to her some of these thoughts about God's omnipotence and his own failure to end the war quickly in a very personal way. You know, he wrote a memo to himself in 1862 where he's saying, the war continues, the now contestants, each wants to win, but God could not favor both of them, but perhaps he favors neither of them. And it's very powerful, but it's very abstract. But to this woman, he's saying it, I have not been able to win the war. I have failed. So therefore, God must have a different purpose than mine. He's speaking very personally. So, you know, sometimes he tipped his hand. That was one of the very rare times. And then he tips his hand for the whole country in the second inaugural. That's all. What do you call that? I call that a sermon that ends in a prayer. It's by far the most religious inaugural address that's ever been given. Yes, sir?
Isn't there a story when he announced the emancipation to his cabinet, and he kind of, under his breath, like Seward or somebody, from saying, you know, this something in reference to his maker.
Yes, yes, yes. That's from Chase, the Treasury Secretary, that Lincoln.
I can't remember the exact quote.
Yes, that Lincoln had said that he had made a promise. He'd promised himself, and then he paused and said, "And my Maker."
Right.
That if we have a victory, then I will issue this. And this was right after Antietam, which was close enough. So yes, he did say that. Yes, yes. Well, he went for the best of Jefferson. And he was certainly aware of that contradiction in Jefferson's life. And I do cover, you know, things that we either know because he refers to them, but he like cuts off the quotation, or you know, he had to have known something. But he, you know, for him and also for public purposes, but I think mainly for him and his own thoughts, he is going to the young Jefferson and to the most important thing Jefferson ever did, which is also what Jefferson thought, that the Declaration of Independence was the most important thing he'd ever done. And that's what Lincoln turns to. I mean, we don't celebrate Louisiana Purchase Day. We celebrate the 4th of July. Okay, thank you very much.